Governor Phil Scott delivered his 2020 State of the State address on Thursday afternoon. Shortly after the governor began his remarks, he was interrupted by protesters urging lawmakers to take action to address climate change. The following recording includes the protest, coverage from VPR's Jane Lindholm and Bob Kinzel during the ensuing recess, and then returns to the governor's speech.
Mr. President, Madam Speaker, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the General Assembly, honored guests and fellow Vermonters. Today, I welcome the opening of the legislative session with the same optimism I had as a freshman senator from Washington County nearly two decades ago. I come before you to report on the state of the state, to reflect on the work we've done, and to share a vision and priorities for our future. As elected officials, it's our duty to distinguish what must be done from what we might like to do and to work together, pulling in the same direction to make a difference for those we serve. We meet at a time in our nation's history when too many elected officials on both sides are choosing confrontation and partisan politics over collaboration.
As you can hear, protesters interrupting the governor's speech right now. The governor standing calmly, watching the protesters, listening to them. They will be escorted out by Capitol Police and security. These are presumably protesters from Extinction Rebellion. Demanding that Hannaford sign a Milk with Dignity pledge. These are members saying that there are climate refugees in Vermont right now maintaining Vermont's dairy industry. Now, listeners, I don't know how much you can hear about what these protesters are saying. Many of them are wearing red. They are flying the Extinction Rebellion flag. That is being taken away by members of the staff of the Sergeant at Arms. But clearly there has been a message, Bob, that these protesters should be allowed to continue what they're saying. And we will have more coverage of this at VPR for people who can't hear all of what they're saying. So I don't want people to think that they won't be getting a sense of what these protesters are saying. But Governor Scott, listening here, watching them.
I think the Capitol Police made a very interesting decision to let this protest play out rather than try to go in and physically remove people from the building. The question will be, how long will they remain tolerant of this protest before they actually decide to move in and do something?
Yeah, interesting to hear this protest and to see the listening. Let's listen in a little bit more.
Okay, thank you very much. We appreciate that. We just did. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
The governor signaling there, Bob, that he is ready for this protest to be done. Presumably there will be some action now to make sure that he can give his speech. The governor and the lieutenant governor speaking together now to try to figure out what the next steps will be.
All right. Have we had enough? Okay. So at this point, we're going to move forward. If you would like to listen to us and listen to my speech, you're welcome to stay. If you don't want to listen to what I have to say, you can be removed.
And so do our children's children.
Got it.
Listen to the people.
Listen to the people.
We demand the people's assembly.
Go oversee
the changes.
Needed to achieve a just transition.
Okay. I think we've had enough.
Nope. Chamber will please come to order.
That's when Lieutenant Governor David Zuckerman.
And in the gallery, please listen to this final offer. We have to proceed with the governor's speech. You have given your message, and the governor has been graceful, as has everybody here, to listen. If necessary, I'll have to declare a recess, and I will ask the sergeant-at-arms and our police forces to remove you. The General Assembly will now be in recess till the fall of the gavel. I would ask the Sergeant-at-Arms and the Sergeant-at-Arms' support to please remove these individuals from the chamber in order to hear the Governor's remarks. Thank you.
Stick around if you want. Recess.
So, Bob, the chamber has been called into recess here. This is unusual. I've never listened to a State of the State address that has been called into recess. There have been protesters. There have been moments where the speech has been delayed or interrupted, but it's very rare to have a protest interrupt the speech to the point where the Senate President, the Lieutenant Governor David Zuckerman, has to declare a recess. Have you seen this before?
I've never seen this before, and, you know, I've covered the legislature for several decades, and this is a first for me as well. You know, it's interesting, Jane, this came right as Governor Scott was talking about how too many elected officials are choosing confrontation over collaboration. And just as he got into that line of we should collaborate more than confront each other, the protesters jumped up and started to take over the chamber. So it's a very unusual situation. I'm not sure it's ever happened before at the Vermont State House. And now we have the situation where some of the protesters are going to have to be physically removed from the building.
Perhaps arrested.
Perhaps arrested. And this is it puts everybody in a very difficult position of how to proceed from here. But I think Lieutenant Governor David Zuckerman determined there was no way that the protesters were ever going to allow the governor to begin his speech again. And so he had really no choice except to call for a recess and have both the state police and the Capitol Police come in and remove the protesters from the chamber.
And you can't hear any noise in the background right now, Bob. That's because we have been listening to the House stream, the audio, which is controlled at the podium by whoever is speaking. So presumably David Zuckerman or somebody else at the podium turned that off for now. They tend to turn it off and then turn it back on when there's activity. So we'll bring you that audio back as soon as we get it. You know, it's interesting, though, to see this happening, Bob, and to think about the Vermont Edition segment that we did just prior to the State of the State address. We were talking about climate change. And one thing that struck me is the measured tone of lawmakers, the measured tone of what needs to happen in the State House as legislation moves forward or doesn't, and what might work, and the many considerations that go into that. And how that compares then to protesters who are saying very clearly in their speaking today, we do not have time to wait. What they say is, and what they feel is, this is a crisis and it needs immediate, swift, and major action. And they don't feel like they're seeing that from the legislature or from the governor.
And it might be a little early in the session to determine exactly which way lawmakers and the governor are going to go. We don't know if the governor is going to address this issue in his State of the State address. My guess is that he would. And in to some degree, he will call for more money for weatherization for electric vehicles, since most, I think the majority of carbon emissions in Vermont are in the transportation sector, and that's where he wants to focus on. So it's a very odd situation at the State House right now. Lawmakers are really scattered throughout the chamber. It's going to take a little while to get the protesters out and for everybody to get back to their seats. And again, this is something that we have never seen before in Vermont. You know, it was interesting just a couple of days ago. In fact, House Speaker Mitzi Johnson warned about the politics of Washington seeping into Vermont and this kind of confrontational politics. And we're seeing a very clear demonstration of it today from people who feel the legislature is not listening to them on climate change. And it'll be interesting to see how this affects the debate at the State House.
Yeah. I mean, do you think that something like this, a protest, something that is this visible and vocal, has any impact on what happens later on in the session as the legislature and the governor think about their priorities? I mean, what's the effect of something like this?
You know, I don't think it has a big effect. I think having these protesters talking to their individual senators and House members might have a greater impact. I mean, this certainly puts the spotlight on this protest, on this issue. But then as the question you raise is, does it have a positive impact on the deliberations at the State House? And my guess is that it can kind of backfire sometimes.
In what way?
Well, I think you got a lot of lawmakers in here now who are pretty annoyed that the governor's State of the State address would be interrupted repeatedly by protesters and that folks have to be escorted out of the chamber and arrested, and that this is not the way that they usually think of having big policy debates in the state of Vermont. And I'm trying to think back on a couple of other occasions that this has happened. In the early 90s, it happened with Governor Richard Snelling and folks who were opposed to Hydro-Québec. But never has it come to something like this where the chamber had to go into recess in order to physically remove people from the building. So it's, yes, for right now, this puts the spotlight on climate change and makes everybody think, okay, what is the legislature going to do? But my guess is if we talk to legislative leaders after this speech, I think their feeling will be that this is not particularly helpful to advance a climate change agenda at the State House.
Protesters now being escorted out of the State House seems to be a fairly peaceful escorting out, although it took them a long time to be willing to leave. As I noted this morning on my drive here to the studio, Bob, even by 9 a.m., the state troopers' cars, the Washington County Sheriff's SUVs, the Montpelier police already lined up in the parking spots in front of the State House. There's a pretty heavy police presence here at the State House on days like the State of the State address. And when there's a planned protest like there was before the State of the State address outside the State House steps, and you may want to go listen listen back in a little while to our conversation that we had with the Capitol Police Chief, Matthew Romei, where he talked about this balance of trying to have accessibility for people to use the Statehouse. And he said, we actually seek out the protesters and say, how can your voice be heard? Now, this will not be the way that he was hoping for their voices to be heard. And he will be directed by members of the House and Senate or by the governor or by the sergeant at arms of what to do, because he said there are House rules and then there are laws, and they may be different depending on what's happening and what he as a police officer may see as a disturbance of the peace is not necessarily something that would require action by the Capitol Police, because if the governor members of the House and Senate say, no, this is fine, we want these people to be heard, then they will be allowed to continue. Now, we did hear Governor Scott saying, okay, we have heard you, we need to move on with my speech. And so that's where things stand here at the moment.
That's right. And I think, you know, it's also a matter of what kind of impact will this have on protests going forward and people's access to the Statehouse. Now, the Vermont Statehouse is one of the very few statehouses in the country that doesn't have metal detectors and heavy security at the doors. Today it does. Today is one of the very few days where bags are being checked. But again, there is a rule that you can't bring a banner or flags into the House chamber. And so those were taken away right away. But the question might be is, how do you find that balance? And I think it's going to be a pretty interesting debate in the next couple of days and couple of weeks of how do you find that balance to make sure that people, everybody in Vermont, is welcome at the Statehouse. At the same time, how do you ensure that the proceedings that are going on are not disrupted? And there's a tricky balance there that has to be met.
If you're just tuning in, this is live coverage from VPR of the governor's State of the State address. Well, what should be the governor's State of the State address? Right now, the House chamber has been adjourned. David Zuckerman, the lieutenant governor, adjourned the chamber saying we cannot continue until protesters are removed. These are protesters, we think, from mostly from the group Extinction Rebellion. They were protesting earlier today on the steps of the Statehouse. They are demanding swift and strong action on climate change. Interrupted the governor. The governor listened to them talk for quite a while and then said, you know, okay, it's time. They went through a series of call and response sort of invocations, and then you could hear it cycle through again. And the governor said, okay, it's time for us to listen to my speech, at which point they didn't leave. And so the lieutenant governor called for the sergeant at arms and for police to escort the protesters from the chamber, saying, if you'd like to listen. The governor said, if you'd like to listen, you're welcome to stay. If not, it's my turn to be able to speak now. I understand that VPR's Peter Hirschfeld is actually locked in at the Statehouse. So presumably the doors were locked to the chambers and he's on the line with us now. Peter Hirschfeld, can you hear us?
Hi there, Jane. I will clarify. I'm not locked in anywhere right now, but I am standing out a first floor meeting room in the Statehouse where various police from different agencies across the state, who, as you mentioned, were here in force, sort of anticipating that this might happen, are leading the protesters into the room where presumably they're going to be processed for civil citations, though I have not been able to confirm that that's the case.
Interesting. And so, you know, this was in some ways perhaps anticipated a little bit, you say, Pete?
Oh, yeah. I think anytime you get that many people who are that passionate about an issue gathered in one space before a big event like this, I think it's hard not to assume that they had something like this in mind when they chose this day to do this rally on the Statehouse steps, which obviously has now migrated into the House chamber.
Yeah, and may migrate back out to the steps of the Statehouse or just slightly far from there. We're now hearing this audio come back on that Lieutenant Governor David Zuckerman, who leads the Senate, is hoping to get people back to their seats, Pete. And I'm sorry for saying you were locked in. It sounds like that was the word I got. Pete is locked in, but I think they meant locked in on the phone. And I'm curious, Pete, if you can still hear me, what that chiming is in the background that you're hearing.
That is the sound signal that people are supposed to be reconvening back in the House. I gather that the folks up there have determined that they have been able to remove the protesters who were responsible for the disruption and are ready to resume with the governor's speech. I'll say it's a very relaxed atmosphere for all the noise you're hearing as people come down from are escorted by police. From the House chamber, I'm seeing a lot of smiles on protesters' faces. Nobody is being, dragged or being physically forced to move from the chamber to the room where they're taking all these folks. So a lot of protesting, but this situation has not risen to any sort of super tense or severe scenario.
And so, you know, as you think about then what the story comes to be out of this speech, Pete, you know, Bob was saying that he's not sure this changes anything once lawmakers are getting down to business in terms of legislation, but certainly it changes how the media reports on the state of the state address. And that may be one of the main points of the protesters, just actually getting out in front of people, getting their message heard. So how do you then figure out how to report on this?
You know, it's a funny balancing act. What's the most important story of today? What the governor of Vermont had to say about his plans for the future of this state, arguably one person who has more control over any single person than the direction we go in, or this group of people who decided to harness this platform to make their point heard. And that's an editorial decision that we all have to wrestle with. I can tell you, having talked to some of the folks that are involved.
And Pete, I think we're going to get the governor back here on the microphone, so I'll go right back to him. Thank you very much, Peter Hirschfeld there.
Thank you for your patience. I'll try not to repeat anything you might have just heard. We meet at a time in our nation's history when too many elected officials on both sides are choosing confrontation and partisan politics over collaboration and progress. Polarization, the us versus them, is our nation's greatest threat. It's weakening our country and the very foundation on which it was built. That's why in state houses and town halls across America, it's up to us to show that people from different backgrounds, with different points of view, as we just saw, can unite around our core values and our common humanity. It's up to us to prove that listening and learning from each other is far more constructive. And it's up. And it's up to us to seek consensus where it can be found and compromise where it cannot. Now, we all know there will be times when we have to agree to disagree, and that's okay. But when it happens, let's assume the best of each other and turn our energy to the areas where a path forward remains. This, my fellow Vermonters, is how we rise above the partisanship, how we reject polarization, how we work towards something bigger than ourselves, and how we, all of us in this room, can best lead our nation forward. I have enormous faith in our ability to achieve meaningful results, and my administration is ready to work with each of you in order to do so. Unfortunately, time is not on our side, because while good things are happening and progress is being made, too many of our counties, communities, and families remain at a critical crossroad. The fact is, where we are as a state and where we go from here is in the hands of every Vermonter. It's in the weathered hands of the dairy farmer and construction worker, and the reassuring hands of the first responder and emergency room nurse. It's in the determined hands of our entrepreneurs and the persistent hands of our teachers, coaches, and mentors. It's in the compassionate hands of family and friends and the helping hands of our neighbors. The state of the state, our values and identity, are guided by, but have never been defined by, what happens in this building. It's the people of Vermont doing all they can to lift each other up who will shape our future. They define who we are and all we can be. World-class innovators like Dr. Marjorie Meyer at UVM Medical Center, who is a leader in the treatment of women with opioid dependence during pregnancy. Entrepreneurs like Kyle Clark, whose company, Beta Technologies, is building electric aircraft, which will lead to a significant reduction in global carbon emissions. Or the volunteer firefighters in Ludlow, who spent their Thanksgiving Day cooking dinner for a mother and her three children, whose stove caught fire that morning. And Gloria Powers from Glover, who provided a home for nearly 400 foster children over 25 years, and at age 72, is still giving back, volunteering at the local senior center. And young Justin Sears from Colchester, who wanted to do something nice for the kids at his school this holiday season and raised over $1,000 to buy his classmates lunch. Then there's Cecilia Hunt from Fairhaven, who for nearly 40 years donated so much of her time to everything from blood drives to food banks and town committees. She's made such an impact that her community reached out to let me know how much she means to them. And by the way, when my staff called her to invite her here, she wouldn't accept credit for 40 years. She said, "It's only been 36. Friends, Cecilia and Dr. Meyer, Gloria and Justin, and members of the Ludlow Fire Department and Beta Technologies are here with us today. Please stand and be recognized.
This is live coverage of Governor Phil Scott's State of the State Address on VPR.
These people and thousands more, those we hear about and those we don't, remind us that we are all part of something bigger and that it's in our pursuit of purpose and in service to others that we find the best of ourselves, our communities, our state, and our nation. So, even as we face major challenges, these Vermonters show that in the hands of our people, doing all they can every day, the state of the state is strong. Inside this building, our job as public servants is to do all we can to ease their burden and build on their strength by setting clear priorities and turning good ideas into results. And here's my biggest concern. Today in Vermont, there are about 55,000 fewer people under the age of 45 and 44,000 more over the age of 65 than there were in the year 2000. For years, we had more deaths than births and have seen more people move out of Vermont than in. And the impact is not the same in every community. We have to acknowledge the real and growing economic disparity from region to region. Think about this. Of the five towns that have seen the most growth in recent years, four of them are in Chittenden County. And in the past 12 years, only three counties have added workers. The other 11 have lost a total of about 18,000. 18,000. That's more than the population of nearly every town or city in Vermont. Of the 180 legislators in this room, 106 of you come from counties that have lost workers. And that's not the only area where we see disparity. From county to county, there's a huge gap between home values, household income, average wage, and so much more. Because of this, across the state, we're feeling the negative impacts in everything, from our homes, schools, and colleges, to our hospitals and nursing homes. If we don't break this cycle, our institutions, including state and local government, won't be able to afford what they currently do or what they would like to do in the future.
because costs will continue to rise much faster than our tax base can sustain. My friends, this is what a demographic crisis looks like. In too many places, in the lives of too many Vermonters, I see and feel the emotional and financial toll of policies built for a few areas in the state that can afford them when the rest of the state cannot. Businesses, families, entire communities doing their absolute best to maintain budgets and meet their needs with fewer options, fewer people, and higher costs than they had last year, and the year before that, and the year before that. Sustainable economic growth has become too hard and too rare in too many areas. It's hurting people. It's regressive. It's creating regional inequity. It's by far the biggest and most immediate challenge to our state and the ability of government to help shape the future. We must act now to give the people of Newport and St. Johnsbury, Hartford and Springfield, Brattleboro, Bennington, Rutland, Randolph, and every other regional economic center and the towns around them the tools they need to survive, to grow and thrive with the self-determination and dignity they each deserve. If we're willing to focus on doing the work, on caring more about the details than we do the talking points, if we can build consensus and trust and avoid national political agendas deliberately designed to divide us, if we focus on the fundamentals, a better, more modern government, a stronger fiscal foundation, and policy that's truly equitable, then our businesses and economy will grow. Putting more kids in our schools and broadening our tax base, making our communities stronger and more resilient than ever before. That's why I had an open mind when Senator Sorokin and the Senate Economic Development Committee had an idea this paid off. They said, remote workers can work from anywhere, so let's give them an incentive to work and live here in Vermont. Since then, we've received worldwide attention. More than $7 million in free advertising, thousands of inquiries, and relocated 371 people to more than 68 communities across 13 counties. Now, we've received our share of criticism as well. Folks who said, you know, I've been living here and dealing with high costs my entire life. Where's my check? I get it. They're absolutely right. We urgently need to make Vermont more affordable for everyone across the state. But this program does help them, because bringing more people here reduces the tax burden on the rest of us. Here are the facts. For a one-time investment of $500,000, based on Vermont's average household income of about $75,000, we project a return on this investment of over $1 million of tax revenue each year. And this is a conservative projection because it doesn't account for the higher than average income of these new Vermonters and the added benefit that comes along with more people buying goods and services from local businesses. We know this isn't the only answer, but this program is a small step towards growing our way out of the demographic crisis facing our state and the affordability crisis facing our families. And this isn't all we're doing. At the same time, we're strengthening training, internship, and apprenticeship programs for Vermonters. We established a first-in-the-nation approach to make it easier for veterans to transition to civilian careers. And we're helping those in recovery or with other barriers to employment find and keep good jobs. This year, in partnership with Secretary Condos, let's further reduce hurdles and costs for licensed professionals so we can bring more of them into the workforce. And my budget will include additional investments in training with an emphasis on the trades and more incentives
for young adults and working age families to stay or move here. It's also important for all of us to remember, over the last 3 years, we've taken steps to help Vermonters keep more of what they earn. This includes removing the tax on Social Security for low and moderate income Vermonters, lowering income tax rates across the board, significantly reducing the land gains tax, bringing the estate tax more in line with our neighbors, and more. But this is not enough. Overall tax and fee burden is still growing far too fast, especially property taxes. And you can expect additional targeted tax relief in my budget. Because ultimately, we need to help people in all parts of the state move up the economic ladder. And the best way to do this is to level the economic playing field and make Vermont more affordable for all families and every business. We've also expanded our view of education, because building the best education system in the nation is one of the greatest economic development tools we could ask for. Rather than just thinking K through 12, we broadened our focus from cradle to career. Together, we've increased state funding for childcare by about $10 million and invested $5 million more in higher ed. And we've added nearly $1.5 million for career and trades training. But here, too, we must move more quickly. The disparity from school to school and district to district is a growing problem. It's unfair to taxpayers and fundamentally unfair to our kids for their educational opportunities to be determined by where they live. We need to be honest. Costs are rising. Yet opportunities for too many kids are declining in too many parts of our state. And so is student performance in areas like reading and math. Reversing this trend has been the driving force behind each of my education proposals. And this year, my budget will once again increase investment in the cradle to career continuum. We'll also support the work of the Agency of Education to improve performance. And if you're ready, I'm still willing to have a discussion on how to direct more of our current spending to our kids instead of letting it be consumed by the growing inefficiency of an outdated system. In addition, I propose to you today that we begin creating a universal after-school network that ensures every child has access to enrichment opportunities outside of current classroom time, and to align the student's day with the length of the workday. A few thoughts on this. First, it's based on a successful model from Iceland, focused on preventing drug use as well as improving academic and social outcomes. And the evidence is clear. Kids who participate in after-school activities and programs do better in school and in life than kids who don't. Second, a universal program expands choices for every kid. It doesn't limit them, and it would be voluntary. Those who currently go home to their families or participate in drama, music, sports, debate, or older kids who choose to work could all continue to do so. Third, it supports working parents by reducing the logistical and financial burden of after-school care. Finally, we're not recreating the wheel, but we are creating more equity. Many schools already have after-school options through organizations like the YMCA and others, but it's far from universal. There are a lot of details to consider on an issue like this, and I fully recognize that as we put the many challenges of Act 46 behind us, one size will not fit all. That's why I've asked Education Committee Chairs, Representative Webb, Senator Baruth, to give this idea some genuine consideration. It's my hope we can deliver this plan by the end of the year that puts us on a path toward universal after-school programs without raising property tax rates.
This is VPR's special coverage of Governor Phil Scott's State of the State address.
We also have a continued need for more housing working Vermonters can afford. In 2017, you joined me in passing a $37 million housing bond, which is leveraging another $170 million in other funding, making it the single largest investment in workforce housing this state has ever seen. Since then, nearly 400 homes have been completed. Another 175 are being built, and about 200 will be underway soon. With almost 800 units, we far exceeded our expectations. And it's already generated $158 million in construction activity, with more to come. And it's not just the housing bond, because alongside additional initiatives, more than 2,000 residential building permits were issued in 2018, the most in over a decade. But because of the economic imbalance from region to region, I still hear about the difficulty of finding an affordable place to live. That's why my budget will include a package to revitalize existing homes and build more of them, targeted to the places that need it most. This is an area where we found common ground, and I look forward to working with you on these proposals, as well as your ideas. I also appreciate the sense of urgency Speaker Johnson and others have placed on modernizing Act 250, which is necessary to build on this progress. The balanced approach we're working on would enable concentrated development where people want to live and work. And when paired with my proposed investments in housing and economic development, will support more vibrant, walkable, and livable downtowns and villages, which, as the Speaker has said, supports economic growth and is a critical piece of our work to combat climate change. For these reasons, I'm optimistic that important updates to Act 250 to better meet the needs of Vermonters can be made this session. We know about half of the emissions that contribute to climate change come from transportation. That's why we've also worked together to make it more affordable to purchase electric vehicles. This is something I'm really excited about. As you may have heard, I'm a bit of a car guy. In fact, I'm probably the only governor who has a CDL and an inspection license. So when I see Ford coming out with a 450-horsepower electric Mustang, seriously, which will do 0 to 60 in about 3.3 seconds with zero emissions, followed by an electric F-150, and Jeep building a hybrid Wrangler, and Amazon's plans to purchase 100,000 electric vans, and then you see Harley-Davidson offering a line of electric motorcycles called Livewire. When you see all this, it's clear this transition is happening right before our eyes. We're on the verge of big advances in terms of technology, as well as competition. We need to be part of it to benefit our environment and our economy. And I'm pleased to report we're making progress. In addition to the privately funded charging stations being installed across the state, we've invested over $1 million in charging equipment. And with investments through the Volkswagen settlement, we expect to nearly triple the number of state-funded charging stations by the end of 2020. And to make EVs even more affordable for low and moderate income Vermonters, we provided $1 million in purchasing incentives. Utilities, auto dealers, many employers, municipalities, and individuals have all stepped up alongside state government. As a result, we've seen a 160% increase in the number of EVs on our roads since 2016. But we know this is not enough. So we're not stopping here. As part of the all-fuels efficiency conversation before the Public Utilities Commission, we're asking that a portion of energy efficiency charges be directed to transportation electrification, We're also using VW settlement funds and federal grants to purchase more electric school and public transit buses. As we look even further ahead, I strongly believe it's incentives, not penalties, which will help us transition more quickly. I hear from Vermonters across the state, like those traveling long distances for work out of necessity, not choice, and others, like our seniors living on fixed incomes, who struggle to fill their gas tanks and heat their homes. I simply cannot support proposals that will make things more expensive for them. Instead, my budget will propose more incentives and a greater focus on affordable clean energy, as well as expanding our battery and renewable energy storage sectors and the jobs they can create. And I'll propose giving small co-ops and municipal utilities more flexibility in order to innovate. From clean energy to our 20-year, $1 billion commitment to clean water, we've shown protecting our environment can be done in ways that also strengthen the economy without making Vermont less affordable for families and businesses. Now, we're also strengthening the health and safety of our communities. We took significant steps over the last year to protect kids, passing legislation to address the vaping epidemic and to ensure drinking water at every school and childcare center will be tested for lead. And this work will continue. Beyond our schools, many of you, alongside the Agency of Human Services, have worked diligently to improve our mental health system. This includes adding inpatient capacity, which is critical to getting people the care they need when they need it. The budget I'll submit will expand this work and focus on prevention, early intervention, and community-level response. Now, I know we're all concerned about the Brattleboro Retreat. This private institution has been around for nearly 200 years. It employs about 700 people, making it one of the region's most important employers since Vermont Yankee was closed. But age and size don't make it immune to the same demographic challenges others around the state are facing. And just like the rest of us, it too needs to adapt. This healthcare provider is simply too critical for us to let fail, especially with no alternative. This would have a devastating impact on our mental health system and the region's economy. We all have a stake here. Just last year, we invested $4.5 million out of the capital bill. That, combined with rate increases, totaled an additional $16 million. And that's on top of tens of millions in Medicaid funding. That's why I've directed my administration to work with you to do everything we can responsibly do to help the retreat, just as we're doing everything we can to help Springfield Hospital as well. I'll also propose a package of criminal justice reforms that we've shared with members of the committees of jurisdiction. We'll look at little things that make a big difference, like waiving license reinstatement fees for suspended drivers and better supporting inmates transitioning to the workforce. And it will also include some bigger changes, like tough mandatory minimums for human trafficking and a provision to address the loophole that has allowed violent, mentally ill offenders to go free. As we continue to create a more effective criminal justice system, we must remember that justice for victims and accountability for criminals must be top priorities.
Governor Scott delivering his State of the State address here. You're listening to special coverage from VPR.
I'm grateful for this opportunity to address our biggest challenges, report on some of our progress, and outline a few of my proposals. There's always much more happening than can be covered in one speech or even two. And I look forward to all of our discussions in the days and weeks ahead. Over the next few months, the way we go about our work will not only determine the results we're able to deliver, but also the strength of our institutions, the faith Vermonters have in us, in the example we set for our kids. We must acknowledge the trying times we live in, the pressure from political parties and special interest groups to fall in line, stay on message, weighs heavily on some. Honest efforts and thoughtful ideas from good people are too often mischaracterized, misrepresented, and belittled. And all of this is intended to divide us and bully us into an us versus them mentality. In this environment, the solutions to serious problems in our state and in our country don't always come fast enough. And to those of us who care more about progress than we do about political power, that can be very frustrating, even discouraging. So when those moments come, I think of the people who inspire me to be part of something bigger, of what they've endured with courage and resolve, and how they show that in the face of incredible adversity, we're all capable of great things. People like my dad, I think of what he went through during his 2 years at Walter Reed and how hard he worked every day just to live as normal a life as he could, how much he accomplished, and how much I admire him. I think about the soldiers with him in France after D-Day, all they went through, how long and horrific those days must have been, and how that generation of Americans stepped up to protect democracy for their generation and those of us who followed. Recently, I thought a lot about Travis Roy, who I heard speak last month. His talent was recognized at a young age. Hockey was his life. He was destined for the NHL. 24 years ago, he played exactly 11 seconds for Boston University before going headfirst into the boards, and then instantly found himself unable to move from the neck down. Travis has spent every moment since ensuring those 11 seconds to find an opportunity, not a tragedy. As a result, he's changed the way his sport is taught. Through his efforts at places like Little Fenway in Essex, he's raised millions for spinal cord research and adaptive equipment. He's shared his story and found his purpose in helping others find theirs. Travis says, "There are times when we choose our challenges, and other times when our challenges simply choose us. And it's what we do in the face of those challenges that define who we are." Don and Greg Tatro from Lamoille County didn't choose their challenge this past year when they lost their daughter Jenna to a fatal overdose. She was only 26. But through their tremendous loss, in the haze of unthinkable grief, they get up every day to help others overcome this deadly disease. They are leading a multi-county effort through their organization, Jenna's Promise. They've created Jenna's House, a community hub for treatment. They purchase a cafe to employ those in recovery. They're providing financial assistance for housing, transportation, and so much more. They've found purpose from loss, helping others to heal. Friends, the Tatro family is here with us today, and World War II veterans from my dad's post in our hometown of Barry, Dr. Joe Aja, Robert Campo, and George Sherlock, as well as Vermont World War II POWs, Clyde Cassidy and Richard Hamilton. Please join me in recognizing and thanking them. They're here to remind us that when our common cause is bigger than politics, there is no challenge we cannot overcome. When I think of these people and others like them, I'm just as motivated, just as eager to solve problems and help people as that hopeful freshman senator from Washington County all those years back. So today, inspired by those we serve and humbled by the responsibilities they've given us, we begin the work of the 2020 legislative session. Our challenges are clear. Can we work together? Can we be guided by our shared principles and common values? Can we reclaim the middle where partisanship can't survive, where we strive for consensus and celebrate compromise? My fellow Vermonters, the answer to these questions and the solutions we seek, the course we hope to set, and the change we need to make is in our hands. If our sense of service and duty is strong, if our commitment to our neighbors is unwavering, and if we remember that we are all part of something bigger than ourselves, then the state of the state, our future, and our people will be stronger than ever before. Thank you.